From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with singer Margaret Whiting. Some of the songs she loves to sing, like My Ideal and Too Marvelous for Words, were written by her father, Richard Whiting. Also today, we meet Adrian Cronauer, the disc jockey who in 1965 actually opened his broadcast with the greeting Good Morning Vietnam. Critic at large Laurie Stone previews the NBC miniseries The Murder of Mary Fagan. It's based on the 1913 hanging of a Jewish factory manager in Atlanta. And folk singer Michael Cooney is back with an old novelty song that's so bad it's good. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is singer Margaret Whiting. Her extended family wrote many of the great songs in her repertoire. Her father, Richard Whiting, wrote the songs My Ideal, Too Marvelous for Words, Guilty, She's Funny That Way, and On the Good Ship Lollipop. Composer Jerome Kern was Uncle Jerry to her. Songwriter Johnny Mercer was like a surrogate father after her father died. Margaret Whiting made her first records for Mercer's Capitol label when she was a teenager in the 1940s. Whiting is currently performing at the Algonquin Hotel in New York. Next month, she'll begin a tour with the group Four Girls Four, which includes Rosemary Clooney, Rosemarie, and Helen O'Connell. Last year, Whiting wrote a memoir about her life and music titled It Might As Well Be Spring. In it, she also wrote about her current relationship with Jack Wrangler, which has raised a lot of eyebrows. Wrangler is a former porn star who made his name in gay films. He's 20 years her junior. Before we hear from Margaret Whiting, let's listen to a recent recording of one of her father's best-known songs, Too Marvelous for Words.
I search for phrases to sing your praises, but there aren't any magic adjectives to tell you all you are. You're just too marvelous. Too marvelous for words, like glorious, glamorous, and that old standby amorous. It's all too wonderful. I'll never find the words that say enough, tell enough. I mean, they're just not swell enough. You're much too much, and just too very, very to ever be in Webster's dictionary. And so I'm borrowing a love song from the birds to tell you that you're marvelous, too marvelous for words.
Margaret Whiting, I bet you remember when your father wrote that song.
Well, kind of, because I was quite young when he wrote it. He wrote it with Johnny Mercer, and it was for Ruby Keeler in a picture called Ready, Willing, and Able. It had to be before 1938, and I'm not sure the year, but I was still young, but I remember going into my father's studio every day when I came home from school or when my mother would allow me in, and he would always play what he'd written that day. So I remember hearing it and liking it, and I still do.
Did you assume that all girls had fathers who stayed at the piano most of the day writing songs?
Yes, because my girlfriend was Harry Warren's daughter, and she and I went to school together, and what she had, I had. In other words, one day at my house, I might have Jerome Kern, Uncle Jerry, or I might have Benny Goodman, who my father did a picture for. Or at Harry Warren's, we might have Tommy Dorsey, or we might have Jimmy Dorsey, or we might have Glenn Miller. We might have young Frank Sinatra, Jack Leonard. So I thought everybody, you know, had the same kind of bringing up. I went to school with William Powell's son and Victor McLaughlin's son and all kinds of people like that, Fanny Bryce's daughter and son. So I just thought, well, everybody had a famous parent, and we didn't even think of them as famous. Oh, Daddy did this, and my daddy painted that, and my father directed this, or my mother was in this picture. And we were all very calm and cool about it, you know, because we were told not to make a lot of it. But everybody, as I write in my book, I said, I grew up in a factory town because the studios were like factories. I mean, you went to school. If you were in a motion picture, you'd go to the studio at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, makeup, hair, whatever else you did in the picture. The producers would come in early to see a scene. The directors would come in, of course, early. And it was like a factory. And it's not like that anymore. I mean, it's serious and work, but the whole thing of Hollywood has changed.
Did you learn all of your father's songs as soon as they were written?
I think I knew a lot of songs when I was 2 and 3 years old. Well, yes, it would be played around the house, and then the records would be played of it, and then people would perform it.
One of your father's better-known songs is on the Good Ship Lollipop, which is, I think, one of his less important songs, but it's a very famous song.
You're right. It is a less important song musically, but it's like it's such a standard because Shirley Temple has lived with so many of us, and that's her biggest song.
Did you have a hard time tolerating Shirley Temple when you were young?
I liked her.
Did you?
I met her, and I went on the set a few times, and she was such a famous person, but such a natural little girl. With all those curls, and she had that great sense of humor, and she could tap dance like mad. And my father adored her. But I was responsible for that song. It's strange, but my greatest thrill was to come home and go into the studio and have my father say, well, this is what I've written. And he would play many songs for me. Or he would say, I'm working on this song, and I'm having trouble. Or he would play Cole Porter's new songs that he had gotten hold of, or Richard Rodgers and Larry Hart. But he was having great trouble writing for Shirley Temple because he had to write a very young kind of a melody, and Sidney Clare, who wrote the lyric, was having trouble writing a lyric. They couldn't come up with an idea, in other words, for this child who was this immense movie star. Had to be innocent, had to be fun, had to be cute. I came in with an all-day, you know, a lollipop, a sucker, but it was a lollipop, and I'd had it all over my mouth. I was sucking it on it all the way home from school. So I gave my father a big kiss, and then I was drooling over the piano. And he said, get away from me. Get away from me. You're so sticky. Get rid of that lollipop. Margaret, that's terrible. You're going to get it all over the piano. That's it. And I thought he'd gone crazy. And he said, that's it. Thank you. Lollipop, lollipop. And he went to the phone, and he called Sidney Clare. He said, Margaret just came in with a big lollipop and got it all over my face and all over the piano. But what a wonderful idea. She gave me the idea. What about Shirley singing on the Good Ship Lollipop? And he was very good at titles. He wrote a couple of lyrics himself. So Sidney said, that's wonderful. I'll call you back. I'll go to work on that. So he said, thank you. He said, give Margaret a big kiss, whether it's sticky or not, and thank her for it. It's a wonderful idea.
Well, you started recording songs when you were a teenager.
Oh, yes.
And they were songs whose lyrics were pretty sophisticated and lyrics about love, like That Old Black Magic. Were you able to comprehend what it was you were singing about as a teenager?
Not really. But I was lucky enough, you know, to have Harold Arlen and Johnny Mercer, as the composer of that, tell me how to do it. Rhythmically, Harold Arlen wrote such great music. I mean, he was really into blues. He was he and Gershwin were the two composers that wrote that kind of music. And
so, what would he tell you?
Well,
when you were singing
one of his songs? Well, he would tell me to emphasize certain notes and emphasize certain words and emphasize certain beats. Like he said, "That old black magic has me in its spell." He said, "Do it like that. Don't go, that old black magic. Don't make it legato. Phrase it. That old black magic has me in its spell." And Johnny would say, use the word black and emphasize it. That old black magic. So those men just, it's like being in a bind or being in a place where the walls closed in and there was nowhere to go but the right way because they were there teaching me.
That must have just been great.
Oh, it was marvelous. And to have all those kind of songwriters around. Johnny and Frank Lesser taught me the importance of reading a lyric. Johnny Mercer often said to me, Margaret, it's like a one-act play, each song. Now, if it's a rhythm song, then you have fun with it. And you find the words to really emphasize, the important words, and you do it rhythmically and you have fun. But on a ballad, if it's a torch song or if it's a story that you want to tell, then you've got to be very careful and you've got to find the climax, where it's going, and do it like a play.
I want to play a recent recording of a song that was your first hit, your father's song, My Ideal. You have known the song and have been singing the song for
many years.
What goes through your mind when you sing it now?
To try to make it new and fresh, as if I'm singing it for the first time, because audiences do not know me, some of them. Audiences do not know the song. But more important, really, is that many people do know, and that's one of their memories of me. So I always have to sing it as well, or if not better than any of the other songs, because that's a memory song to them. And they love the fact my father wrote it and I sang it. So I try to think of, it could be Jack, whom you know that we'll talk about, that I go with now. It could be a love when I was a kid, but it's an image of someone that could be my ideal, and will I recognize him? In other words, again, reading the lyric and getting that innocent, honest, first time I ever sang it feeling.
Let's listen to my guest, Margaret Whiting, singing a song written by her father, Richard Whiting. This is My Ideal.
Long ago, my heart and mind got together and designed a wonderful boy for me. Oh, what a fantasy! Though the idol of my heart can't be ordered a la carte, I wonder if he will be always a fantasy. Will I ever find the boy on my mind, one who is my ideal? Maybe he's a dream, and yet he may be just around the corner waiting for me. Will I recognize that light in his eyes that no other eyes reveal? Or will I pass him by and never even know that he was my ideal? Will I recognize that light in his eyes that no other eye I'll trust in fate, and so I wait for my ideal, for my ideal.
My Ideal, sung by my guest, Margaret Whiting. Margaret Whiting has written a new memoir. It's titled It Might As Well Be Spring. It's a really beautiful rendition of it, and I should say that this was just recorded a few years ago.
Well, it's one of my favorite songs, and it was my father's favorite song. he would play this before he'd start to write something else. He adored this song, and he'd always say, oh, God, I hope I can write another one like it. And there's something kind of special about it. It was my beginning, my roots on records, and I used to sing it before even I started on records. I was on NBC for 2 years with Gordon Jenkins and David Rose conducting for me, and I'd always sing this song along the line because it was one of the first songs I knew, and it kind of fit me. So whenever I sing it, it's special.
I think so many of us grow up with our expectations about what love will be like, with those expectations shaped by the pop songs that we listen to.
And the books we read.
And the books
and
the movies we see.
And the shows we see. And the Valentines we send.
But we sing along with the pop songs. And,
oh, certainly.
And the lyrics just really become part of our visions. Now, you sang those pop songs professionally when you were young. You sang those pop songs before you really knew firsthand
Absolutely.
About love. Did they shape your idea of what love and romance was supposed to be like?
Well, I think that we're all born here with a certain group of rules or a foundation where we would go to school, we would grow up, we would find our first crush in school probably, and it probably wouldn't work out, and eventually we would meet somebody and we would get married and we would have children and it would last forever. And thus is not the case, as most of us find out.
You're pretty frank in your book, and you even write about losing your virginity and how you almost wanted to just get it done with because you'd heard it wasn't so interesting the first time around.
Well, that's right. So that's absolutely true. And you're the first person that's brought that up, but it just was something that I'd heard, you know, that's something to get over with and get on with living. I'm not so sure today. If I knew today what I know at that age, I wouldn't have done it that way.
But I almost had the feeling reading your book that you were doing it to get a, more of a sense of what the songs were like that you were singing.
I wanted to grow up in it. I wanted to know what love was and sex was and all these words that people were throwing around and living that I wasn't.
All the double entendres in the songs.
Sure. I mean, you know, it's interesting, but it was very sophisticated out in Hollywood, too, and everybody, the group that you live with out there, unlike, let's face it, Hollywood is one place. Hollywood has many people working in many different businesses, bankers, doctors, lawyers, everything, and Los Angeles is a great big city, but in my group, I was raised with people in show business. And it was a certain way of living, and it was much more sophisticated because we were doing make-believe, we were doing pictures, we were doing television, we were doing all these things, and it was what everybody dreamed about. I mean, I've had kids come to me and say, oh, you came from Hollywood. Is Hollywood Boulevard golden?
So tell me, did having sex change your interpretation of songs?
I think so. I think I said, oh, that's what it's all about.
Margaret Whiting is my guest. We'll continue the interview after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Singer Margaret Whiting is my guest. You came of age professionally during World War II.
Yes, absolutely.
And even, I think, toured a few times with Bob Hope.
Oh, I toured with him. I was with him for 7 years. So I toured a lot of places with Bob Hope.
What did you learn from those tours, both about show business and about things like timing?
Oh, everything. When you work with someone like Eddie Cantor, and I was fortunate enough to work with Eddie and Jack Carson, and then Hope, if you start to move on a line, he grabs you. He says, never move on a line because the audience watches the movement.
You mean like on a punchline?
Yes. Or anything. If you're gonna go back and forth. Hey, Bob, I heard you went to Camp Jun today. Did you have a good time? And if I start moving, whatever he's going to say, they're going to pay attention to me. They're not going to hear the punchline. And timing is such an important thing. I learned it from Red Skelton. Learned it from all these marvelous geniuses, Jack Benny, that I worked with.
Barry Manilow met you, and this is when he was the music director for Bette Midler, and when she was playing the Bath in New York, and he took you to see her. He liked your singing, and you were interested in his songs, and he took you to see her at the Bath?
Yeah, I knew him before that. And one night he said, it's my birthday, and I'd like to go hear Carole King, and we did. Then he said, I've got my band, and we're going to play for a girl I'd met Bette before. So we went up to the Baths, which was just where men went, and they were all dressed in towels, and I was put behind a rope, and Bette Midler came out, great as she is, and just rocked the place, and then she got me up to sing Moonlight in Vermont, and they loved it. So on the way home, I said, Barry, I got to tell you something. Don't lose this woman. She's brilliant, and you're a terrific combination.
Your life has been changed in the last few years with your relationship with Jack Wrangler, and I'd love to hear the story of how you met him. And
I went into a restaurant one night, and there's a wonderful place in New York. There was a wonderful place where everybody would go in show business and everybody else called Backstage. And there was a piano player there, and we would be introduced by the owner, Ted Hook. And he had introduced this charming gentleman that I was looking at across a table. But I thought I knew him. And they'd said his name was Jack Wrangler, and he was doing such and such a picture. I wasn't paying much attention. Then they introduced me, and I got up and took a bow, and then Jack came over to the table. He said, I've loved your singing, and I'm an admirer, and I think you're terrific. So I said, I knew him. Now, I had met him as Jack Stillman, who was a director in Chicago and doing all the top shows there. But he had gone to a gym, and his body had changed, and he's changed his hairstyle. So I said, I didn't recognize him. I said, what are you doing here? And he said, well, I'm doing my act. So I said, good, I'd love to see it. He said, well, you can come next Wednesday night. I'll have my stage manager leave tickets. So that was that, and he left. And Ted Hook came over to me and said, you said you were going to see his act? I said, yes. He said, do you know what he does? I said, no. He said, well, he makes porn pictures. I said, you're kidding. He's so charming. He says, he is charming. I said, Ted, I don't understand. A week ago, he introduced me to Jamie Gillis, who was going with a gal that's a wonderful food critic, and he's in porn pictures. And I said, a few weeks before, you introduced me to Harry Reams. What is this? He said, well, they're all great guys, and they all come to the restaurant. So anyway, it was too late. I thought about it, and so a girlfriend of mine and Ted Hook and somebody else went with me. We went to the theater. Jack couldn't have been nicer. He was very charming. He got up. He talked about how he got into porn pictures and some of the funny things that had happened, and he introduced me, and I got up and took a bow, and then he came to out front and said, I'd love to see you again. So we made a date for brunch. And we sat at my house for a while and went downstairs to brunch. And I found out that he had the same kind of background I did. He came from Beverly Hills. His father, whom I knew, was Robert Stillman, because my sister's husband was Gail Smith, is Gail Smith, and he sponsored for General Motors the Bonanza show, and Jack's father was the producer. He had been a kid star. He'd won an Emmy for Faith of Our Children. And he'd been directing, and then suddenly, I don't know, he wanted to get out of that. He wanted to go back to Hollywood and act, and he couldn't get a job. He tried. So he got a job in a play, and I guess he took his shirt off, and then he took his pants off. He wasn't nude, but somebody came to him and said, we want to do another play. And some film man saw him and said, would you do this part in this picture? And he got into it, and that's how he got into it.
He made his reputation in gay porn films.
First, and then he went into heterosexual films.
It must have been seemed a potentially very treacherous kind of relationship to get involved in.
Yes, and I had no intention of getting involved. But we had the same kind of background. We went to the same schools, years apart, went to the same dancing schools. And then you've met Jack, and you know the kind of person he is. He's a very fine person. And I realized that he'd gotten into this somehow, and he didn't know how to get out. And by then, they wouldn't give him a regular kind of a job. But then I talked to Jack, and I said, look, you're a very fine director, and you're a good actor, and you've blown it. You know, you've got such a potential. You should come to New York, where they're far more forgiving and understanding. And he's done several, when I say straight plays, I mean, they have nothing to do with X-rated things at all. And he's just written a very funny, charming play for, hopefully it'll get to Broadway, with two of my friends. And it's wonderful. It's called I Love You, Jimmy Valentine. And all of this is behind him. And he realizes that there was no future in it. But he was stuck in it in a while. There was nothing else he could do.
There's a 20-year age gap between
yes.
you. You're 20 years older than he is. And I wonder if being in a relationship like that has made you feel older or younger.
It's made me feel just as I always feel. I'm Margaret Whiting. Age has never meant an important thing to me because I enjoy good health. I have a wonderful zest for life. And Jack and I have a terrific time. We work together personally in the act. He'll do my act. He'll direct my act or find me material. I help him with what he's doing. I listen to every scene that he writes. I helped him with his book. I mean, I read every chapter and made suggestions. He wrote a very funny, wonderful book called The Jack Wrangler Story, or What's a Nice Boy Like You Doing? And it did very well. And we're very helpful to each other and as people. We find there's a need for each other. And we've never even worried about the age.
We only have a couple of minutes left. There's one other thing I wanted to ask you about singing. You grew up the daughter of one of the great American composers, Richard Whiting. Your extended family were some of the greatest composers, Jerome Kern and Johnny Mercer. Did you grow up thinking that to sing a song you really had to stick to the composer's intention, stick to what was on the page, both the lyric and the music? Because a lot of singers will stray from that and will reinterpret a song.
Well, I reinterpret now, but I certainly did stick to what they said because my father said to me, look, sing the songs the way we wrote them. Took us a long time. That's our craft. We're professional. And that stuck with me. And, of course, Johnny and Harold and everybody said, you know, sing in the way we wrote them or the way we sing them as we teach them to you. But recently I've had more of a jazz sound and gone in a little bit different direction, as has Rosemary Clooney. But I think we're still singing them traditionally, but in a different way. I mean, I'm not going to louse up a lyric because I adore those lyrics. And I'm certainly not going to, I may bend a note here and there, but I'm going to give it a different conception, but within the architecture of the song, the foundation of the song, because that's the way I was taught. But stylists are the people that take a song the way I sing it and then do it completely differently, and bravo for them.
Well, I want to thank you very much for sharing so much about your life with us.
Well,
thank
I had
you
a
for
ball.
Being here.
I really had a ball. I enjoyed it. I hope I can come back.
Oh, I hope so, too.
I'd love to.
Margaret Whiting is singing at the Algonquin Hotel in New York for the next 6 weeks. Next month, she goes on tour with the group Four Girls Four, which includes Rosemary Clooney, Rosemarie, and Helen O'Connell. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Dr. David Elkind. His new book, Miseducation, warns of possible dangers to children who are pushed too hard to achieve too much at too early an age. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Good Morning Vietnam, the way it was really said in 1965 by Adrian Cronauer, the Armed Forces radio DJ whose experiences are the basis of the new Robin Williams film. Also, folk singer Michael Cooney laments the lost art of novelty songs and resurrects an old country and western novelty. And critic at large Laurie Stone previews The Murder of Mary Fagan, an NBC miniseries about anti-Semitism. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. The law that allows the judiciary to appoint an independent counsel to prosecute current and former government officials was declared unconstitutional today. A 3-judge federal appeals panel in Washington ruled that the law violates the constitutional separation of powers. The 2-1 decision threatens the perjury conviction of former White House aide Michael Deaver. But the investigations into the Iran-Contra affair, as well as criminal probes of former White House aide Lynn Nofziger and Attorney General Edwin Meese, do not appear to be affected. Prosecutors in those 3 cases accepted parallel appointments by the executive and judicial branches. The independent counsel in Deaver's case did not. At the Geneva arms talks today, the U.S. presented a draft treaty on space-based anti-missile weapons. More from Burton Bolag.
Today's new treaty language formalizes the joint statement made at the end of last month's Washington summit meeting. It follows the presentation last week of a Soviet text, also based on the joint summit statement. However, that statement was sufficiently vague to allow substantial differences between the 2 sides. Today's American proposal stresses the U.S. readiness for close consultations to ensure predictability in the deployment of President Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative. But U.S. negotiator Henry Cooper told reporters today that even though the U.S. is ready to respect the ABM Treaty's ban on deployment for several years more, it intends to push ahead with research, development, and testing of new space-based arms. The Soviets, for their part, are calling for greater restrictions. For National Public Radio, this is Burton Bolag in Geneva.
One of 3 youths convicted in the Howard Beach trial was sentenced today to up to 30 years in prison for manslaughter and assault. 18-year-old John Lester is the first to be sentenced in the case of a black man chased to his death on a New York highway more than a year ago by a gang of white teenagers. 2 other youths convicted in the case are scheduled for sentencing later this month. Arizona Governor Evan Meekum and his brother today pleaded innocent to a total of 9 felony charges in connection with their alleged failure to properly report a $350,000 campaign loan. Laura Carlson of member station KJZZ in Phoenix has details.
Although the governor's appearance in Maricopa County Superior Court was brief, it was nonetheless historic. Meekum is the first Arizona governor ever to face felony charges. Court Commissioner Patrick O'Neill read the governor his rights and released him without bond under the conditions that Meekum remain a law-abiding citizen, be present for all future court appearances,
and that you are not to leave the state of Arizona without prior court approval, except when in the official performance of your public office.
In addition to the indictment on charges of fraud and perjury, the governor could also be impeached by the Arizona legislature. A House committee is continuing hearings this afternoon to learn more about charges that the governor deliberately concealed the campaign loan, misused public funds, and blocked an investigation into an alleged death threat against a grand jury witness. The governor also faces a probable recall election this spring. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Carlson in Phoenix.
An estimated 50,000 right-to-life demonstrators converged on Washington today to mark the 15th anniversary of the Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion. At a pre-protest news conference, opponents of Roe v. Wade declared their movement to overturn the decision is very much alive. Speaking to the protesters by telephone, a supportive President Reagan said he has sent to Congress a so-called pro-life law.
We will soon publish regulations that will cut off federal family planning funds from abortion-related activities. The law prohibits using Title X money to encourage or promote abortion in any way.
President Reagan. Stock prices posted strong gains on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 24 points to close at 1903.51. I'm Sharon Green, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. For this week's performance spot, we've asked back singer and guitarist Michael Cooney. During his years as a performer, Cooney has developed a huge repertoire of songs ranging from old pop standards to maritime ballads, traditional folk and children's tunes. Today he'll perform another one of his specialties.
I like old-time novelty songs. They always have these clever ways of saying things, and I kind of lament sometimes that people don't do that nowadays, but I realized that I was neglecting the entire body of country western music, all those songs so bad they're good, songs like Drop Kick Me Jesus Through the Goalposts of Life, or I Gave Her the Ring, She Gave Me the Finger, or You Left Your Footprints on My Stomach When You Walked Out of My Heart. The flood of my tears has washed out the bridge of my nose. There is an unending number of them. My favorite of all of those is I don't know you from Adam, but if you're gonna play the jukebox, please don't play A11. Doesn't that get you right there? The great thing about those songs is that you can't tell if they're serious or not with the really good ones, and this is my favorite of all of those. A hulk of a man with a beer in his hand, he looked like a drunken fool. And I knew if I hit him right, why I could knock him off of that stool. But everybody said, hey, watch out, that's Tiger Man McCool. He's had a whole lot of fights, and he's always come out the winner. Yeah, he's a winner. But I'd had myself about five too many. I stepped up, tall and proud, faced his back, faced the fact that he'd never stooped or bowed. I said, Tiger Man, you're a pussycat. And a hush fell on the crowd. I said, let's you and me step outside, see who's the winner. Well, he gripped the bar with one big hairy hand. He leaned against the wall, slowly stood up from his beer, and my God, that man was tall. He said, boy, I see you're a scrapper, so just before you fall, I'm gonna tell you just a little about what it means to be a winner. Now you see these bright, white, smiling teeth, you know they ain't my own. Mine rolled away like chiclets down the street in San Antone. But I left that person cursing, nursing seven broken bones. And he only broke three of mine. Guess that makes me the winner. Now behind this grin, I got a steel pin that holds my jaw in place. A trophy of my most successful motorcycle race. And every morning when I awake and see this scar across my face, it reminds me of all I got by being a winner. Yes, my broken back was the dying act of handsome Harry Clay. That sticky Cincinnati night I stole his wife away. And you know, son, she gets meaner and uglier every day. But I got her, boy, and that's what makes me a winner. Now you have to speak loud when you challenge me, son. You know it's hard for me to hear with this twisted neck and these migraine pains and this big old cauliflower ear. And if it wasn't for this glass eye of mine, why, I'd shed a happy tear to think of all you're gonna get by being a winner. I got arthritic elbows, boy. I got dislocated knees. from picking fights with thunderstorms and charging into trees. And my nose been broke so often, I might lose it if I sneeze. Son, you say you still wanna be a winner. Well, you remind me a lot of my younger days with your knuckles clenching white. But boy, I'm gonna sit right here and sip this beer all night. And if you got something to gain or prove by winning some silly fight, well, okay, I quit. I lose. You're the winner. I stumbled from that barroom, not so tall, not so proud. And behind me, I still hear the hoots and hollers of the crowd. But my eyes still see, my nose still works, my teeth are still in my mouth. And you know, I guess that makes me a winner.
Michael Cooney is based in Rockport, Maine. He writes a regular column for the folk song magazine Sing Out. This is Fresh Air. How did you sign on the first morning that you did your show?
The same as I did every other one. We would have a little bit of music from an album called Like Tweet by Joe Puma and the Audiobon All-Stars. And then I would say, "Good morning, Vietnam," and then start into the program that way.
That was Adrian Cronauer. In 1965, he used to wake up the troops in Vietnam with his early morning Armed Forces radio show. Now Robin Williams uses Cronauer's famous sign-on in the new movie Good Morning Vietnam. Williams stars as Adrian Cronauer, the DJ who brought top 40 music to the Armed Forces radio service in Saigon. When Cronauer's tour of duty was up, he returned to the States and continued working in broadcasting. Now, at the age of 49, he's changing careers. He's a second-year law student at the University of Pennsylvania. Cronauer came to Vietnam after doing an Armed Forces radio show on the island of Crete. I asked him what the radio station in Saigon sounded like when he got there.
If you've seen the film, you'll notice at the very beginning, there was a very dull, dry, boring, soporific announcement about how to get your hold baggage if you'd lost your duffel bag or your trunk out of Tonsonute Air Base. That is as accurate a depiction as is humanly possible of what the station sounded like when I got there. And one of my aims was just to make it sound more like a stateside station.
Now, from seeing the film Good Morning Vietnam, it's my impression that before you came and did your show, that the popular music show was mostly Mantovani, Perry Como, Ray Conniff.
I think that's a lot of that is Hollywood exaggeration. Sure, there was that. But it was the overall sound of the station I was concerned with. And again, in the film, it seems as though the power structure of the military was violently opposed to this, and that wasn't the situation at all. It was more a matter of apathy. The general attitude seemed to be, well, gee, it sounds perfectly fine to me the way it is. Why are you making waves? It's not broke. Stop trying to fix it.
Did you get an immediate reaction from the soldiers who were listening to your show?
No. The reaction that's shown in the film is way overblown. We did not get mailbags full of letters and cards, and we did not have a bank of phones taking requests. First of all, there was no place where anybody could phone in from anyway. But secondly, there was a reaction that I would get mostly when I went out into the field. We would get an occasional card and letter, but if I go out doing interviews, people would say, "You're who?" And I'd say, "Kronauer." And they'd say, "Oh, yeah, I think I..." And I'd say, "Good morning, Vietnam." "Oh, yes, of course." And I found out later on that many times the GIs, although the program was popular and they enjoyed it, if I'd do the "Good morning, Vietnam" on a particularly bad day, they'd boo and hissed, and occasionally some would yell at their radio the GI equivalent of, "Get stuffed, Kronauer."
What did you play the most when you were on the air?
Whatever happened to be currently popular, again, looking at what were the popular songs in the States and assuming that the GIs who came over from the States would want to hear what's popular back at home. Our whole idea was, whether it was in the music policy or the production that we did on the air, it was to make it sound as much as possible like a stateside radio station, to give them a little link with home as a morale factor.
Those of us who weren't in Vietnam have very vivid images from movies, for instance, from Apocalypse Now, where there's rockets going off in the air and bombs and the Doors are playing in the background. Do you think that you had something to do with bringing rock and roll to Vietnam?
I probably had my small part to play, as every person who worked at AFRS did. I don't think that I was the catalyst or the significant moving force in getting rock and roll in Vietnam. I think rock and roll got to Vietnam because rock and roll is the kind of music that is popular. It was popular then, and it still is. And so it would make little sense to try and put up a station that was a morale factor without having rock and roll on it, sure.
In the movie, the Robin Williams version of Adrian Kronauer is censored when he wants to read the real news that comes across the wire. All the news that comes over the wire is first presented to censors. And in the movie, the character witnesses a bombing at a restaurant that a lot of the army men hang out in, and he's not allowed to mention that on the air. Similar things happen to you?
On the subject of censorship, the movie is very accurate, except in one small detail. We did not have censors on premises at the stations. It was done by phone. But there was indeed a restaurant called the Mekong Floating Restaurant. It was built on a boat that was moored in the Saigon River. And one evening, I had dinner there with some friends from the station. And after dinner, we were still hanging out in the area when the Viet Cong sprayed the boat with shrapnel from a Claymore mine. And then about 3 or 4 minutes later, when everyone was panicking and trying to get off the boat, they aimed another Claymore mine directly at the gangplank and did a lot of carnage. And I heard the report of the explosion and the commotion and went back to see what was going on, tried to help out a bit, and then went back to the station to see if I could put the item on the air. And I called the duty officer for permission to put the story on the air and was denied permission, and I asked for a reason, and he said, "We have no official confirmation of this happening yet." And I explained that I had been there in person, had seen it with my own eyes. And the answer was still no, we have no real confirmation of any casualties. And I said, "Sir, with my own eyes, I've seen heads severed from torsos. Barring the second coming, they will not get up and walk away." And the final answer was no, and the final reason was, "Well, suppose we're wrong."
So you didn't...
No, I did not go lock myself in the studio and put it on anyway, no. In fact, there are a lot of things in that movie that Robin does. If I had actually done them, I would have been court-martialed and I'd still be in Leavenworth.
When you were on the air, were there any signs in the control room that there was actually a war going on?
It was basically a traditional, ordinary, run-of-the-mill radio station control room. The only real reminder of the war was the fact that on the console, beside the turntables, was a loaded 45. Over in the newsroom, there was another one beside the teletype machines, and we were instructed that if it was necessary, we were expected to use it.
You were in Vietnam in 1965, and that was a year that the war really escalated.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the things that you saw that made you realize that the war was really changing?
When I got to Saigon in May of 65, it was a sleepy little French colonial town. And in 1 year's time, I saw it turn into a nightmare. The massive influx of American personnel, equipment, armament, money, turned the city upside down. When I left, the black market was flourishing, the economy was in disarray, the traffic was unmanageable, the entire city was ridiculous. And although I found it a very enjoyable place to be when I first got there, in the context of that it was a war going on, I was very glad to get out.
When was the first time that you saw the movie Good Morning Vietnam?
In October, I went out to California with my wife and we saw The Rough Cut. And then in the middle of December, it premiered in New York and we saw the finished product there.
What was your reaction the first time you saw the completed movie?
Well, for about 5 minutes or so, it was difficult to get used to the idea that, well, that's Adrian Cronauer up there, but I'm Adrian Cronauer, but he's me, but I'm here. And then finally, I just settled down and said, all right, relax, enjoy the movie.
Well, Adrian Cronauer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Here is Adrian Cronauer, as played by Robin Williams.
Good morning, Vietnam! Hey, this is not a test. This is rock and roll. Time to rock it from the Delta to the DMZ. Is that me or does that sound like an Elvis Presley movie? Viva Da Nang. Oh, Viva Da Nang. Da Nang me, why don't they get a rope and hang me? Hey, is it a little too early for being that loud? Hey, too late. It's 0600. What's the O stand for? Oh, my God, it's early. Speaking of early, how about that Cro-Magnon?
This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's coming up?
Well, we're following the White House policy on the Strategic Defense Initiative for Star Wars. Have they changed their line with Moscow on what must be agreed to? We'll hear a report. Also hear from New York Times reporter Philip Taubman, based in Moscow, just back from his second trip to Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan. He reports it strikes him as though the Russians there intend to be leaving within a year, regardless of what kind of deal is struck.
Oh, well, let's get back to America for a second. Any news on the primaries?
Well, I don't know about news, but we'll hear the Dole stump speech, what Senator Robert Dole tells the people as he goes from place to place with Linda Wertheimer.
Well, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic at large Laurie Stone has some thoughts on the NBC miniseries The Murder of Mary Fagan. Laurie is interested in its perspective on anti-Semitism.
Most of the time that anti-Semitism is treated in the media, it gets mythicized. It's seen as so diabolical as to be beyond human understanding, and it's privileged as a unique atrocity. Unfortunately, this is a view that winds up scanting other forms of race hatred. In fact, every bigotry has a unique history. It's a position that also, unfortunately, fits hand in glove with the Jewish romance of being Jehovah's chosen people. NBC's 5-hour miniseries, The Murder of Mary Fagan, gives us a worthier view of anti-Semitism. The show airs on January 24th and 26th, and I recommend it. It's based on true, harrowing events, and while it remains clear-eyed about the particular development of anti-Semitism, it skillfully illuminates the political contexts that heat this poison to a boil. The year is 1913, the place Atlanta, Georgia. The economy is so depressed that cotton sells for 5 cents a pound. On a Saturday in June, pretty 13-year-old Mary Fagan, who works at the pencil factory, goes to manager Leo Frank's office to collect her week's wages, $1.10, and a few hours later is discovered dead. The girl had clearly put up a struggle, but although Frank, a northern Jew, hasn't a single scratch on his body, he's arrested, tried without evidence, convicted on hearsay testimony, and sentenced to hang. The film is dramatically wobbly, but the lead actors, Peter Gallagher as Leo Frank and Jack Lemmon as Georgia Governor John Slayton, turn in graceful performances. The show has the built-in suspense of an unfolding mystery, and most importantly, it gives each factor in Frank's case its due. The whole is ultimately deeply disturbing. The show achieves its effects by focusing less on the division between Jews and anti-Semites than on the separation between power and powerlessness. We're led to sympathize with the poor whites and blacks until they form a mob against Leo Frank. We dislike Frank for not paying his workers better, but feel for his victimization. We mistrust the governor until he's prepared to take a stand and possibly sacrifice his career. We feel contempt for the politically ambitious prosecutor who uses a black man to denounce Frank and stokes anti-Semitism to win his case. And we loathe the party boss who controls everyone in the state and calls all the shots in the trial. This setup, the movie makes clear, could as easily be Eastern Europe 1913. A Gentile girl is found dead. Jews are accused of using her blood to make matzahs. A gypsy or a member of some other hated minority nails a Jew. Nationalist sentiment is aroused, pogroms are encouraged, and all the frustration of the disenfranchised is siphoned from socialist rebellion into Jew hate. It happened here, just about like that. Balladeer is made a folk heroine of Mary Fagan. The day Frank was sentenced, thugs bashed the windows of Jewish businesses in sections of Georgia. The guilty parties were never brought to justice, and the figures most responsible for the episode gained immense popularity as a result. The murder of Mary Fagan frequently alludes to the race hatred of blacks, and thus does anti-Semitism a justice by lining it up in the heinous parade of bigotries.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic, and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Martin Levan, the sound designer for Andrew Lloyd Webber's new Broadway show, Phantom of the Opera. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review the album Nine Below Zero, featuring pianist Wayne Horvitz, cornetist Butch Morris, and drummer Bobby Previtt. And television critic David Bianculli will preview Television, a PBS series that examines the medium by showing archival clips and interviewing the creative people behind them. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.